The following Dharma talk was given by Danika Shoang Ankele Osho at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shoang Osho is a Dharma holder and priest in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered freely. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. Good morning. Shugen Roshi is on vacation this week, so it's my humble honor to offer some words. We're going to start with a poem, a short poem by Ryokan, the unconventional poet monk of the 18th century, 19th century. I guess his life spanned those centuries. And he was born into a family where his father was a local leader. And rather than follow that track, he ran off and became a Soto Zen monk. And trained for a while in a temple, and then left the temple and became a wandering hermit, and is remembered for his poetry and calligraphy and his embodiment of the Zen spirit. Even if you consume as many books as the sands of the Ganges, it is not as good as really catching one verse of Zen. If you want the secret of Buddhism, here it is. Everything is in the heart. Even if you consume as many books as the sands of the Ganges, it is not as good as really catching one verse of Zen. If you want the secret of Buddhism, here it is. Everything is in the heart. I was reminded of a couple of anecdotes about Ryokan, so I wanted to share them because they're so good, and because they both reminded me of Yukon. And so here, this is from Kaz Tanahashi, has a book called Sky Above, Great Wind, which is a collection of translations of Ryokan's poetry and then some biographical sketches. And he translated some written anecdotes by people who knew him. It's recent enough in history that that kind of thing is available. So here are a couple. Ryokan stayed with us for a couple of days. A peaceful atmosphere filled our house, and everyone became harmonious. The atmosphere remained for some days, even after he left. As soon as I started talking with him, I realized that my heart had become pure. He did not explain Zen or other Buddhist scriptures, nor did he encourage wholesome actions. He would burn firewood in the kitchen or sit in meditation in our living room. He did not talk about literature or ethics. He was indescribably relaxed. He taught others only by his presence. Here's another. At a tea ceremony, a very solemn ritual, Ryokan picked snot out of his nose and indiscreetly tried to set it on the right side of his seat. The guest on his right pulled his sleeve and cautioned him not to do that. Ryokan then tried to set it on his left, and the guest on his left side pulled his sleeve. Having no place to put his snot, he put it back in his nose. I feel really good about having that as a luminary of our school. If you want the secret of Buddhism, here it is. everything is in the heart. What does this mean? I think we can spend a lifetime clarifying, practicing to really understand what this means. And I think if we do that, it's a good use of a lifetime. What is the heart? So important to note once again that the word that's translated again and again and again into English and most of the Buddhist teachings is shin, which is the word for heart and mind, not separated out, but normally we encounter it as mind. So I think we would do well to sort of take that in a deep way. And maybe, I mean, sometimes I like to make a swap, you know, and put heart in where mind appears and see how that opens. We're not in a cerebral tradition, right? That's very much an aspect of Zen. Is it's non-conceptual, not intellectual. And so it's good to remember we're sitting to realize our heart, the true nature of our heart. And hopefully, as we practice more and more, we can touch in with our heart. We can feel what that means just in an embodied way. I've noticed, I don't know if some of you have, that it seems like of recent years, Shugen Roshi is more and more easily sort of moved to the verge of tears. Being touched by life. One way of thinking about realizing our heart is to reflect on connection and the profundity, the deep connection that is our one body, one mind, one heart, and then the practice of connection, which is bottomless and challenging and so restorative and healing and so desperately needed at the present time. There's a Zen phrase from way back to kind of speak about the quality of connection or one heart or what we realize. A single thread pierces multiple holes. So you can take that in. What are the holes? Multiple holes. It's said that Dogen's successor, Ajo, heard that phrase and came to realization. And they have an exchange where Ajo goes to Dogen and says something like, I don't ask about the single thread, but what about these multiple holes? And Dogen says, completely pierced. And Hong Zhe, who's about a century or two before Dogen, wrote, if you truly appreciate a single thread, your eye can suitably meet the world and its changes. So just as a thread stitched through various cloths creates a whole, one thing, inseparable, unified. So too, a single thread connects us all. What is it? Of course, Zen is so famous for saying words and letters can't reach it. So we could use a word or a phrase like Buddha nature. Buddha nature is this single thread piercing multiple holes. And interestingly, I was having coffee with a new acquaintance last Hosan who is a long time Buddhist practitioner, decades, I don't know, since the 60s, certainly since the early 70s. Yeah, I think since the late 60s. And now a practitioner, having started in Zen, now a longtime practitioner of Vajrayana Buddhism and a translator. She knows Tibetan and has lived in Nepal and has translated many texts over the years. She's in her early 80s. And she said that at one point, and, you know, some of these translations that have come about through a collaboration. So you have multiple translators looking at a text and making decisions together about how to render a certain word. And she said that for Buddha nature, at one point she was advocating to use the phrase original goodness. And someone else who was there with us that morning said, oh, I really like that. Because Buddha nature, it's like so abstract. It sounds like so far out there. Like, oh my God, my Buddha nature. Am I ever going to realize that? But original goodness? Oh, like that I can relate to. And she was saying that, that rendering, one of the reasons that it was passed over or, you know, not favored was because it was in such stark opposition to original sin. And people at the time thought, ooh, it's just a little edgy to do that. Original goodness. This practice, Zen practice, is so much about feeling into and making contact with this deep, deep connection, right? It's such a direct practice, and kind of in a sense, I mean, once you start thinking about it, it's like, almost everything we do, you could look at through that lens. You know, I think about like the Zen form of, you know, the Jikido strikes the bell and everybody bows and we all get up and we smooth our seats and we bow to our seat and we turn and bow to each other and da, da, da. And you can sort of get, particularly if you're newer, caught in like trying to learn the form and it's like, oh, it's like choreographed or, but when you've relaxed into it, it is a practice of one body. I mean, to me, that feels like that's kind of the fundamental point, you know? And then there's all of the ways that connection and bringing connection out manifests in the liturgy. I mean, this morning I was thinking about like, oh, we go to some trouble to recall our connection to the ancestors, right? Every service is dedicated. And this morning we chanted the lineage, the disciple, teacher, disciple relationships that have come down to us here today. And then, of course, when we're chanting the Bodhisattva vows or all Buddhas throughout space and time, this is an invocation of connection and a vow to connect and live in connection deeply and plumb the depths of that. You know, even this gassho, this is a gesture of two becoming one. So the next time you're bowed out of meal crew, take in the deeper resonance there. That, you know, sometimes the language will talk about oneness. And I found another, speaking of translations and different ways that words are used and the things that opens up for us, there's a newish book out called Throw Yourself into the House of Buddha, which is a collection of talks by Tongan Harada Roshi, a contemporary Japanese Zen master who passed away in 2018 and who's really considered kind of one of the true like embodiments and practitioners of like a realized deep lineage in Japan. And in this book of talks, he speaks about blending with whatever you encounter. I thought that was very helpful. Blending with whatever you encounter. Sometimes I can hear oneness and think like, I don't know. But, you know, it feels like a rarefied experience, maybe, to me, to be like one with sweeping, let's say. But to blend with that experience. Blending with whatever you encounter. And this original goodness, we live in the midst of it all the time. In a sense, our Zazen practice of non-doing, of just sitting in silence in the room together, is deep faith. We don't have to like run around and like make Buddha nature happen. Actually, we do the opposite. And so how is it? Given that this is the original state, how is it that we fall into disconnection from a place of fundamental belonging? We can feel alienated, estranged. The scholar and Catholic priest Thomas Berry, who later in his life really concentrated his brilliance on reflecting on the ecological crisis and the sacred relationship of human beings to the earth. He pointed out that, you know, we need the healing beauty. This is him, it's a direct quote. We need the healing beauty of the natural world. We need the beauty for our imagination. To destroy the outer world is to destroy the inner world. He said the universe is a communion of subjects, not a collection of objects. As we recover our awareness of the universe as a communion of subjects, a new interior experience awakens within the human. The barriers disappear. An enlargement of soul takes place. The excitement evoked by natural phenomena is renewed. Dawn and sunset are once again transforming experiences, as are the sights, sounds, scents, tastes, and feel of the natural world about us. The surging sea, the sound of the wind, the brooding forests. All this could be continued in a never-ending list of experiences that have been lost to large segments of the human community in recent centuries. Not because the phenomena do not surround us constantly, but because we have become locked into ourselves, as though large segments of the human mind have become paralyzed. It is no wonder that humans have devastated the planet so extensively. It was only a collection of objects to be used. We have become locked into ourselves as though large segments of the human mind have become paralyzed. I hate to tell you that that was written in 1998, before everyone carried a smartphone in their back pocket, before teenage suicide had been tied to TikTok and Instagram posts. Before AI. Are we serious about this? I mean, great, fine. I'm sure there's so much good that can come from it. And like, we should be so careful. We should be so careful. Contact. That's really what we're looking for. Not more information. Or better solutions? The solution is here. Contact. I also feel like this aspect of our practice of taking care of things is another beautiful way to practice connection. You know, the practice of not wasting. Of valuing things. And then there's the sort of human practice realm of connection. And when it's good, it's good. And when it's bad, it's really hard. So how do we stay connected, like even when there's tension or conflict? Divergent views. I want one thing and you want another. When it seems like we're disconnected on the surface, like, can we actually trust and practice trusting and practice relating from that single thread? I will just share a little tidbit. This past week, we had a monastics meeting, and we were together sharing about the ways that we either see unwholesome patterns in ourselves or how we might hear the voice of Mara, you know, your inner demons. And one thing that I noticed in my own reflection and then in hearing other people's reflections was this kind of like sense of like looking for like resolution. You know, you have a discomfort or a unwholesome mind state, and it's like looking for resolution. And I asked the genuine question in the group, like, how do you resolve that? Like, where's the resolution? And in a sense, I was asking in a personal way, because I'm just noticing in myself the very old pattern of kind of going negative and the way that can swallow a lot of energy sometimes lately. Not so much now, because I asked that question and someone in the group said, well, you know, I don't think that you can really resolve it. It's not so much about resolution, but it's about connection. Oh, yeah. Isn't it true? Isn't it true? For those of you who are here for the weekend session, you know, Gokhan shared in his talk that anecdote of struggling with something and then sort of being reminded, like, well, you're not alone in this. You could reach out to the other people in the group. And the way that eased, it was one contributing factor that eased the condensation of that situation. And I was thinking about, like, it's so hard to, if we're in a place of disconnection, it can be so hard to connect. And, like, it's so profound. And what happens there? Like, what's actually happening? Like, I wonder if you could sort of get a machine, maybe AI could make such a machine, that could, like, map, like, what someone's energy is doing, sort of your energetic, subtle body when you're disconnected and then when you're connected. I mean, I'm sure it's, like, obvious. Maybe some of you can see that. I don't have that ability, but I'm sure it's obvious. You can see it, how it manifests, right? And, like, the brightening of eyes or the softening of tone or, like, a tension that was in the body releases. Like, it's so palpable. So maybe we don't need that machine after all. Forget it. Forget it. But I came across this beautiful teaching from Plum Village, Thich Nhat Hanh's community. And I was thinking about invocation, you know, and invoking the bodhisattvas and their qualities. And of course, the bodhisattva qualities are our qualities. We have them, but they're, you know, a little rusty, a little creaky, a little encrusted. And so the bodhisattvas sort of bring them out in full splendor, and then we can be aspire, like, oh, right, compassion. I have compassion. I just need to, like, polish it up a bit, you know? And what I loved about this series of invocations is that it's like invoking the bodhisattva and their brilliant qualities, and kind of, If you listen, it's not a stretch at all to hear, like, oh, this is invoking the bodhisattva to open the doors of connection interpersonally. And could be so healing and could be so helpful and is a good reminder for those times where the affliction of disconnection seems to be what we're working with. We invoke your name, Avalokiteshvara. We aspire to learn your way of listening in order to help relieve the suffering of the world. You know how to listen in order to understand. We invoke your name, Avalokiteshvara, so that we might listen with all our attention and open-heartedness. To listen without any prejudice, without judging or reacting. To sit and listen in order to understand. We will sit and listen so attentively that we will be able to hear what the other person is saying and also what is being left unsaid. We know that just by listening deeply, we already alleviate a great deal of pain and suffering in the other person. And there's one for Manjushri, which is invoking Manjushri to learn Manjushri's way of looking deeply into the heart of things and into the heart of people. To look with open-heartedness, with unprejudiced eyes, without judging or reacting. We will look deeply so that we'll be able to see and understand the roots of suffering and the impermanent and selfless nature of all that is. And it goes on for Samantabhadra and Jizo Bodhisattva. And so this question of how do we show up for each other? And the primacy of connecting to ourself It's got to happen here. So we have good, authentic ground. And so that's bodhisattva practice too. And that's a big part of what we're doing. This connection, how do we honor it, maintain it, realize it? It's brought out in the bodhisattva vows. It's brought out in the precepts. All of it about rediscovering this single thread. And if that's too esoteric, I think of what the Dalai Lama said when asked about his religion. My religion is simple. My religion is kindness. I have a poem. It's a longy, but it's a goodie, okay? And that's what I'm gonna share, and then we'll close. And before I go into it, well, you know what? I'll probably share it, and then I'll say just a little bit more about it. We'll see. It kind of speaks for itself. On Kindness by Aracely's Girmay. At the Detroit Metro Airport, with the turtle hours to spare between now and my flight, there is such a thing as the kindness of the conveyor belt who lends me its slow, strange mollusk foot as I stand quiet, exhausted, having been alone in my bed for days now, sleeping in hotels, having spent months now without seeing the faces of my family. Somehow its slow and quiet carrying of the load reminds me of the kindness of donkeys. And this kindness returns me to myself. It reminds me of the kindness of other things I love, like the kindness of sisters who send mail wherever you are. And speaking of mail, there is the special kindness of the mail lady who says, "Hi, baby," to everyone. At first, I thought it was just me, but now I know she says, "Hi, baby," to everyone. That is kindness. Two, there is the kindness of windows and of dogs. And then there was that extraordinary Sunday back at the house. I heard a woman screaming about how she was lonely, and so lonely she didn't know what she'd do, maybe kill herself, she said, over and over, like a parrot in a cage, a parrot whose human parent only taught it that one sentence. I looked out the window and saw her from behind, the way she flung her arms like she was desperate and being killed or eaten by an invisible predator like a tiger or a lion in the chest. And her voice seemed fogged out with methadone, I don't know, something. And I walked away from the window and sat angry with her for screaming and sad. And not long after, I heard her saying, "What'd you say? What'd you say to me?" And a man's voice, low. I could not tell if it was kind. And she said, "I'll kill myself. I'm so lonely. And did I tell you yet that it was Mother's Day? Flowers and mothers all day long." And the woman saying, "I'm so lonely. I could kill myself." And then quiet. And the man's voice saying, "It's okay. It's okay. I love you. It's okay." And this made me get up and put my face again to the window to see my landlord's nephew outside, just hugging her so, as if it were his mother. I mean, as if he belonged to her. And then again, quiet. I left the window but sat in the silence of the house, hidden by shutters, and was amazed. When the front door of the brownstone opened up and let the tall nephew in, with his sad and cougar eyes, handsome and tall in his Carolina Brooklyn swagger, I heard him start to climb the stairs above me, and my own hand opened up my own front door, and though it was none of my business, I asked him, "Do you know that woman out there? And do you know what happened next?" He said, "No." The nephew said, "No." He didn't know the woman out there. And he told me happy Mother's Day as he climbed the rest of the stairs. And I can't stop seeing them hugging on the street under trees. It was spring, but cold. And sometimes in the memory, his head is touching hers. And sometimes in the memory, his eyes are closed. And sometimes she is holding him and singing to him, "I love you. It's okay. I mean to tell you that everywhere I go, I hear us singing to each other this way. I mean to tell you that I have witnessed such great kindness as this, in this, my true life. You must believe me. I mean, on a Sunday, when nobody was supposed to be watching, nobody at all, I saw this happen, the two of them hugging, when nobody was supposed to be watching, but not a secret either, public as the street, not for glory and not for a joke, the landlord's nephew ready to stand there for the woman, like a brother or a sister or a husband or son or none of these at all, but a stranger, who, like her, is an earthling. Perhaps this thing I'm calling kindness is more simple than kindness, rather recognition of the neighbor and the blue shared earth and the common circumstances of being here, what remains living of the last 2 million impossible years. Blending. A single thread. Can we please remember this and practice this? No matter what the future brings. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.